The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the April 26, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the White House advisor, Stephen Miller. He's standing in the foreground, kind of a nondescript expression on his face. He's got his arms folded. Behind him is one of those oversized yellow construction dump trucks. The bed is tipped up. And there looked like a bunch of migrants being dumped out of the truck, some of them hanging on to the side, some of them already falling out. And the title is Miller's Revenge, The White House Plan to Dump Migrants in Sanctuary Cities. And that will be our main story, but I wanted to start with the editor's letter this week. In the Week's office, the country's major newspapers are laid out in a line each day along a counter. One day last week, the same spooky image stared out from every front page, like a cosmic eyeball. The first ever photo of a black hole. It's an achievement once thought impossible, given that black holes exert such monstrous gravity that they swallow light itself. To see the unseeable, it took 200 scientists on four continents using 8 radio telescopes, synchronized so that they functioned like one giant radio dish the size of Earth. Even Einstein, whose theories predicted black holes, initially doubted something so outlandish could exist. Now astronomers have captured what one looks like, a radiant orange-red ring of superheated gas swirling around an ominous void, the event horizon, where all matter and energy is sucked into no one knows where. The value of feats like this are not entirely scientific. They remind us that human beings are not always petty, small, and mean, and that at our collaborative best, Homo sapiens is capable of magnificent things. Over the last century, science has shown that our universe is a far stranger place than our everyday experience would suggest. Space itself is curved and warped by mass. Time slows down on an object the faster it travels. Electrons act both as particles and waves. Entangled particles seem to instantly know and react to what happens to their partner across vast distances. At the quantum level, there is no empty space. Particles constantly pop in and out of existence, creating an ephemeral quantum foam. At the other end of the scale, there are at least 2 trillion galaxies in the universe, each containing billions of stars and probably more than a few planets where intelligent life has evolved and is puzzling over the same questions as we are. The more we discover, the more it becomes clear that our certainties, whatever they may be, are built on illusions. We live in a great mystery. That was from William Falk, the editor-in-chief. And we'll go right on into the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's plan to dump migrants. What happened? President Trump said last week that he is strongly looking at a plan to transport immigrant detainees from the southern border to sanctuary cities as retribution for Democrats' refusal to support his border policies, as his administration ratcheted up efforts to stem the influx of Central American migrants. The proposal to bus migrants to Democratic-controlled sanctuary cities, like New York and San Francisco, was championed by White House senior advisor Stephen Miller. The Washington Post reported, but was shot down as inappropriate and expensive by officials at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. One day after the story was published, Trump tweeted the plan remains under strong consideration. It's retaliation to show them your lack of cooperation has impacts, a Department of Homeland Security official told the Post. Trump taunted sanctuary cities, saying they're always saying they have open arms. Let's see if they have open arms. Attorney General William Barr ruled this week the government can hold adult asylum seekers indefinitely if they enter the country illegally, even if it takes years until their court date. Trump's frustration also led him to suggest illegal means of blocking the migrants, according to several news reports. During a visit to Calexico, California, CNN reported, Trump told border agents to simply refuse to let migrants reaching U.S. soil apply for asylum, and to reply if a judge questioned them, "Sorry, judge, I can't do it. We don't have the room." CNN also quoted administration officials as saying Trump told acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleenan he would pardon him if he ever went to jail for denying U.S. entry to migrants. The White House denied this. Border authorities are grappling with the biggest migrant surge in 12 years. As families flee poverty and violence in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the number of families crossing the border is up 300% over 2018, and the average tally of immigrants in ICE custody, including both families and single adults, swelled to more than 50,000, an all-time high. Since December 21st, ICE said it has released 125,000 migrants into the U.S. who arrived as families. What the editorial said, "Let's hope that Trump is just trolling Democrats," said the Wall Street Journal. "Flooding sanctuary cities will only increase the likelihood these migrants will remain in the U.S. for years under city and state protection. And since most sanctuary cities are in Democratic strongholds, swelling their populations with new non-citizens will only add to their strength in reapportionment for Congress after the 2020 census." Yes, the Supreme Court will soon hear a case about whether the Commerce Department can include a citizenship question in the census, but a legal victory is far from certain. "If America is full, as Trump claims," asks the San Diego Union-Tribune, "why are employers desperate for seasonal employment visas for foreign workers? Employers are facing such a profound labor shortage amid record-low unemployment that they crashed the Labor Department's electronic system with nearly 100,000 requests for these visas within the first 5 minutes. And, by definition, these visas can be granted only when there are not enough U.S. workers who are able, willing, qualified, and available to do the temporary work. Indeed, employers report 7 million unfilled jobs." What the columnist said, "Trump is not only urging officials to break the law to stop immigration, he's openly musing about using violence," said Alex Ward in Vox.com. After telling reporters he wanted more troops at the border, the president bemoaned how if the military got a little rough with asylum seekers, everybody would go crazy. "We shouldn't dismiss this as just more Trump tough talk. Our commander-in-chief is saying he wishes American troops could have more freedom to hurt men, women, and children." "It's time for Trump to admit the obvious," said David French in NationalReview.com. "Despite his tough talk and empty threats, he's failing on his signature issue. He needs a course change, one that recognizes the reality that Congress sets America's immigration and border enforcement policies. That means deal-making. That means compromise. The alternative is more flailing and more chaos." "Yes, but Democrats don't want to negotiate," said Brett Velikovich in FoxNews.com. "By offering nothing other than saying no to Trump, They are essentially advocating open borders. Democrats refuse to change the asylum law because they actually welcome the unbridled flood of humanity now pouring into our country. Since the sinister Stephen Miller is the chief architect of Trump's immigration agenda, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post, Democrats should summon him to testify before a congressional committee. Though Miller largely operates behind the scenes, he is playing a major role in so much of the chaos, incompetence, and increasingly malevolent extremism gripping the Trump administration right now. Hearing from him could shed light on Trump's efforts to flout the law and the colossal mess he's making of border policy. Our controversy of the week, Barr, why he's probing spying on Trump campaign. Attorney General William Barr just keeps on delivering for President Donald Trump, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. Barr first proved his loyalty by dismissing the obstruction evidence against Trump gathered by special counsel Robert Mueller and issuing a one-sided, misleading summary of Mueller's report. But the partisan Republicans' shamelessness reached an alarming new peak last week when he seemed to confirm Trump's paranoid fantasy of an attempted deep state coup against him. Testifying before a Senate subcommittee, Barr declared he would be investigating government spying on Trump's 2016 presidential campaign when the FBI grew concerned that Trump associates' numerous contacts and connections with Russians. Under grilling by incredulous Democrats, Barr sort of walked back that claim, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. He clarified that he was talking about electronic surveillance, such as that conducted on former Trump advisor Carter Page, and said he wanted to find out whether that surveillance was adequately predicated. Predictably, Trump seized on Barr's reckless allegation to proclaim that the Russia investigation was illegal and to accuse investigators of treason. Actually, everything Barr said was demonstrably true, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. Not only did the FBI surveil Carter Page, they used an informant, Professor Stephen Halper, to gather intelligence on Page and fellow Trump advisors George Papadopoulos and Sam Clovis. In applying for wiretapping warrants on Page, the FBI also cited the now infamous Steele dossier, assembled by a former British intelligence agent getting paid by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Democrats are outraged that Barr had the temerity to call spying spying, said Ben Weingarten in TheFederalist.com. But what really terrifies them is what a full investigation of the investigators will reveal. Barr mustn't be deterred. We need to know how and why U.S. intelligence agencies came to spy on a presidential candidate's campaign so that it never happens again. We already had that investigation, said Rick Wilson in TheDailyBeast.com. Twice. The Justice Department's Inspector General has been studying the Russia probe's origins for more than a year, with no finding of wrongdoing. Meanwhile, a House GOP effort to expose the plot against Trump ended in the travesty of the deceptive and highly partisan Representative Devin Nunes memo, which no one outside of Fox News took seriously. So why is Barr promising yet another investigation? Intimidation. He wants every federal prosecutor and intelligence official to know that if they dare again to investigate this president, they will face persecution and prosecution. What Trump's defenders are effectively saying, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post, is that there should never have been any FBI investigation at all into the Russia attack on U.S. election. This despite the established fact that Russia mounted a comprehensive effort to get Trump elected, including hacking and releasing Democratic emails. targeting key voters on social media, and making dozens of contacts with Trump campaign officials. To imply that the FBI should have ignored all this is utterly bonkers. Maybe the term spying was indeed too pejorative, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com, given that Barr doesn't have all the facts yet. But we need to know how much the FBI and other intelligence officials were legitimately and understandably freaked out by some of the Russia connections of Trump associates, and how much they acted out of partisan malice. Barr should investigate, release his findings, and let people decide for themselves. Let's see what we have in our good week, bad week segment this week. Seems it was a good week for adjustments. With assurances from Joey Gallo and Nomar Mazara of the Texas Rangers that they will stop grabbing each other's crotches as part of their ritualized home run celebration. "We apologize for that," said Gallo. "It was a good week for holding your fire. After armed police responding to a home invasion call in Oregon, found the suspect cornered in a bathroom and burst in to find an active Roomba robot vacuum cleaner whose noisy collisions with the walls had alarmed the house sitter. It was a good week for pampered dogs after The Wilson, a restaurant in Manhattan, debuted special dishes for dogs and their owners to share on an outdoor patio. The menu includes a $42 grilled ribeye with baby vegetables and a $14 bowl of mixed berries. But it was a bad week for the hirsute, with new research showing that men with beards carry more bacteria than dogs do in their fur, with nearly 40% of beards tainted with microbes that are hazardous to human health. Dogs can be considered as clean compared with bearded men," said Professor Andres Gutzeit of Switzerland Hirsch London Clinic. It was a bad week for the Swiss after the government of Switzerland ruled, incorrectly, that coffee is not essential to life and that the nation's emergency stockpile of the substance can therefore be abolished. And finally, it was a bad week for state media after an irritated President Trump tweeted it was so weird to see his favorite network, Fox News, host a town hall event for Democratic presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. Trump also complained about how smiley and nice the moderators were with the left-wing Sanders. And a short piece before we leave this page. DOJ seeks to weaken emoluments clause. After President Trump took office, the Department of Justice narrowed its reading of a constitutional rules that bar U.S. officials from receiving payments from foreign governments. According to a forthcoming Indiana Law Journal article, the department's new interpretation of the emoluments clause allows any official, including the president, to accept payments from foreign governments as long as the money comes from commercial transactions. Several lawsuits argue that China, Saudi Arabia, and other countries patronize Trump Organization properties in an effort to curry favor with the president. The Justice Department's rebuttal echoes a 2017 position paper from Trump Organization lawyers who said, "Paying for a hotel room is not a gift or a present." The title of our briefing page article is "The Mafia Today, While La Cosa Nostra no longer reigns supreme over organized crime, the mob is far from vanquished. Is the mob still alive? It would have been easy until a few weeks ago to assume Italian-American mobsters were extinct. And that's exactly how Francesco Frankie Boy Calli liked it. Investigators said Calli ran the Gambino crime family like a ghost, conducting business strictly in person to avoid wiretaps and insisting that his underlings do the same. Yet Calli, 53, was splashed on covers of New York City tabloids in March after being shot 6 times outside his Staten Island home. It was the first murder of a mob boss since 1985, when Gambino head Paul Castellano was gunned down outside Spark's Steakhouse in Midtown Manhattan by 3 trench coat wearing men under orders from John Gotti, who watched the cinematic rub out from a car across the street. Gotti became a notoriously flamboyant boss, but the Dapper Don's celebrity status attracted intensive law enforcement attention and led to his downfall. That was a fate Calli was determined to avoid when he became the crime family's capo. His murder allegedly resulted from a personal feud, not a mafia rivalry. "The mob is alive and well," said William Gale, head of the FBI's Organized Crime Task Force in New York. "They've learned the attention is not good for business." How big are their ranks? "There are about 3,000 members and affiliates in the U.S., said the FBI estimates. In Castellano's day, there were double that number in the New York area alone. Yet the same 5 families, Gambino, Bonanno, Colombo, Genovese, and Lucchese, have survived since Charles Lucky Luciano founded the commission, the mafia's governing body, in the early 1930s. Luciano helped establish the family structure, with dons and their captains managing associates who had yet to become made men. There were 26 families during the mob's heyday in the 1950s, stretching from Boston, Providence, Buffalo, and Philadelphia, through Al Capone's Chicago outfit, to Hollywood and Bugsy Siegel's New Frontier in Las Vegas. Today, the mob is concentrated around New York. How's business? After Gotti received a life sentence for murder and racketeering in 1992, the mob retreated to their caves. Mafia biographer Selwyn Raab said, "They refocused on what Raab calls their bread-and-butter rackets: illegal gambling, loan sharking, extortion, and drugs, mostly heroin." Calli's crew allegedly worked as a conduit between Latin American drug cartels and Sicilian traffickers. Still, business is way down from Gotti's era, when the Gambino family allegedly pulled in hundreds of millions a year. At its peak, it used control of Teamsters unions and other organized labor to take a steady cut from food distribution, construction, sanitation, and clothing manufacturing, at one point collecting a $3 tax on every piece of clothing from Manhattan's garment district. Today, the mob remains heavily involved in cargo theft, extortion of port workers, and drug smuggling in New York Harbor. "The one thing that they are," said Walter Arsenault, executive director of the city's waterfront commission, "is adaptable." Why the smaller profits, then? Competition, for one. By the 1920s, immigrants from southern Italy had prevailed over Jewish and Irish gangsters, making millions on bootlegging during Prohibition. Except for some collaboration with powerful criminals like Meyer Lansky, Italian mobsters mostly kept business within the family. Meanwhile, other ethnic groups from Russia, Latin America, and Asian mimicked their model and eventually became more sophisticated. New recruits for the Italian mob are in short supply, so families often pay temporary associates to do specific crimes. "Loyalties are thin," retired FBI agent David Shapiro said. "You know the gig economy? Well, we've got a gig mafia now." Isn't the mob a lifetime job? It used to be. Under the rules imported from Sicily, newly inducted wise guys swore to never betray their family and to honor omerta, the code of silence. But after Congress passed the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act, RICO, in 1970, bosses could be prosecuted for their organization's crimes, and dozens of mobsters flipped and testified for the prosecution rather than go to prison for decades. In 1986, Rudolph Giuliani, then U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, used RICO statutes to convict the heads of three families and five underlings. After Lucchese head Alphonse D'Arco discovered he was marked for death, he became a government informant in 1991, and his testimony led to prosecution of more than 50 mobsters. Testimony from Gambino underboss Sammy the Bull Gravano helped take Gotti down. And in 2017, federal authorities arrested 19 members of the Lucchese family, including its top two bosses, on charges of racketeering and murder. Disloyalty had crippled the mob, and D'Arco said he'd never go back to his mafioso ways. But as far as living day to day, he said, I take that life any blanking day of the week. We'll start into our best columns of the week with one from Scott Jennings at the Los Angeles Times. Why everyone was rooting for Tiger. The world can now finally relate to Tiger Woods, said Scott Jennings. When he was young and golf's most dominant player, Woods was cool and aloof, which deprived fans of the warm feelings they had for sunny champions such as Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and Phil Mickelson. Later, Woods' personal mistakes led to a series of public scandals that cost him his marriage, his reputation, and his once unshakable confidence on the course. Then serious back problems and spinal fusion surgery seemed to end his career. So when Woods completed an incredible comeback with a stirring victory at the Masters last Sunday, it was a redemption story millions of Americans could cheer. I watched the final hole in an airport lounge, and when Woods' last putt settled into the hole, everyone there stood and clapped and joined in euphoria over Tiger's amazing comeback. As a parent, I was deeply moved by seeing him tightly embrace his son and daughter, with the crowd's roars ringing in their ears. They'd seen their dad at his worst, but now they, too, have seen him at his best, a champion who overcame his mistakes, rebuilt a broken body, and simply refused to give up. This is from France. A nation mourns after Notre Dame inferno. The fire that ravaged Notre Dame de Paris this week has scarred the soul of France and sent an immense wave of sadness across the planet, said Le Monde in an editorial. For more than 850 years, the Catholic cathedral has been the heart of Paris. It survived the Revolution of 1789 and the Nazis. German generals defied Hitler's orders to bomb it. Its bells rang our joys and our sorrows, tolling for the liberation of Paris in 1944, and after the November 2015 terrorist attack that killed 130 people in our capital. Now Notre Dame has been gutted by a massive blaze that apparently broke out by accident on the roof, where renovations were ongoing. Parisians and tourists flocked to the terrible sight, and when the burning spire toppled, the crowd gasped and wept. They were living the nightmare Victor Hugo had imagined in his novel, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Grieving onlookers began singing hymns and Ave Maria for Our Lady. For all lovers of art and civilization, she was a sumptuous Gothic jewel, a miracle of architecture, and an invaluable museum. The cathedral's two stone towers and its facade survived, said Alexis Fierchak in La Figaro. But the wealth of masterpieces and sacred objects lost could be immeasurable. Notre Dame housed three relics from the Passion of Christ, a piece of the true cross, one of the nails, and the crown of thorns Jesus wore at the crucifixion. In the first sign of hope, authorities said they had saved those relics, but the fate of other treasures is not known. The 76 huge 17th and 18th century paintings that hung throughout the cathedral could not be unhooked from the walls, and their condition is uncertain. At least they are damaged by smoke and soot. At worst, they are ashes. The rose windows seem to be intact, but the lead that holds them together may be fatally weakened. The great 18th century organ is still standing, but its pipes, made of alloy of tin and lead that is vulnerable to heat, may no longer sound. How could this happen? Asked the economist. Some 500 firefighters rushed to the scene, but they were delayed in evening traffic, and by the time the water cannons were deployed, the fire had spread across the roof. France is still in shock, but soon it will search for somebody to blame. Already, questions are being asked about disaster planning for a monument of this scale and national importance. President Emmanuel Macron said, we will rebuild no matter the cost, said Julien Courbet in La Croix. In the aftermath of the blaze, business and donors pledged some $1 billion for the reconstruction effort. How strange that a country so deeply secularized, de-Christianized, would feel its heart crushed at the sight of a church in flames. In this Easter week of resurrection, we vow that Notre Dame de Paris will be reborn from the ashes. And we'll finish the columns with one from China. Soothsayers just want your money. Chinese people have always believed in fate, said Yan Yuming. But we also believe we can change it. We try to optimize our fortunes by consulting the zodiac and choosing houses or wedding dates with lucky numbers. And now we're consulting online fortune tellers. These supposed sages are all over the Chinese internet, and they will even read your fate via WhatsApp or WeChat. Some friends recently encouraged me to try a digital fortune teller for career advice after I complained of feeling stressed in a new job. I forked over 50 yuan, about $7.50, and was told to type in my name, gender, birthday, place of birth, city of residence, and field of work. The self-proclaimed soothsayer warned me that because I was born in the year of the dog, I'd have bad luck until 2022. But, he said, there was hope. I was due for an unexpected windfall, and he could tell me about it if I just paid some extra money. It was obvious this was a scam. Online fortune tellers are preying on the gullibility and superstition of the Chinese. They fleece people in the name of predicting the future. China has modernized so rapidly that it's understandable to feel disoriented. But in seeking comforting answers from strangers, we're making ourselves easy marks. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, The Strokes That Created Dr. Rapp, R-A-P-P. A 63-year-old doctor's seizures left him obsessed with poetry and speaking in rhymes, said journalist Jeff Mache in The Atlantic, and made Sherman Hirschfield a legend in the L.A. hip-hop scene of the early 2000s. Dr. Sherman Hirschfield woke up one morning and was surprised to find himself behind the wheel of his car. Somewhere between his Beverly Hills apartment and his practice in the San Fernando Valley, the silvered-haired physician had blacked out. Somehow he'd avoided a crash, but this wasn't the first time. "I didn't know what was going on," he admitted. Apart from his frequent blackouts, Hirschfield was in fine health for a man in his 50s. He was tall and lean, ran 6 miles a day, and was a strict vegetarian. Hirschfield specialized in physical medicine and rehabilitation, and for decades had helped patients with brain injuries learn to walk again and rebuild their lives. Still, Hirschfield didn't know what was wrong inside his own head. Not long after the blackout started, Hirschfield suffered a grand mal seizure, the type most people imagine when they think about seizures. He was driven to the emergency room, thrashing like a 6-foot-4-inch fish pulled out of the water. The scan revealed that his blackouts were actually a swarm of small strokes caused by blood clots that could kill him at any moment. Doctors prescribed blood-thinning medication and forced Hirschfield to quit driving. Like many survivors of stroke, his speech became slurred, and he sometimes stuttered. His personality also seemed to change. He suddenly became obsessed with reading and writing poetry. Soon, Hirschfield's friends noticed another unusual side effect. He couldn't stop speaking in rhyme. He finished everyday sentences with rhyming couplets like, "Now I have to ride the bus, it's enough to make me cuss." And curiously, whenever he rhymed, his speech impediment disappeared. A stroke or brain attack can happen to any of us at any time. One occurs every 40 seconds in the United States, and they can lead to permanent disability and extraordinary side effects. Some patients become hypersexual or compulsive gamblers. There was a famous guy in Italy who had what they called Pinocchio syndrome, said Dr. Alice Flaherty, a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. When he told a lie, he would have a seizure. He was crippled as a businessman. One of Flaherty's most famous cases was Tommy McHugh, a 51-year-old British man who suffered a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a stroke caused by bleeding around the brain. A grizzled ex-con, McHugh became deeply philosophical and spent 19 hours a day reading poetry, speaking in rhyme, painting, and drawing. For Hirschfield, a love of poetry was also completely out of keeping with anything in his past. He was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, in 1936, and while his mother was a concert pianist, he followed his father into medical school. In 1973, he arrived in Southern California and set up his practice. He had little time for reading anything but medical journals. The practice ran into financial trouble, and by 1987, he'd filed for bankruptcy. That was around the time the blackout started. In the 10 years following his stroke, Hirschfield dedicated his free time to a Buddhist organization called Soka Gakkai International, where he loved to chant for hours. He met his second wife there, Michiko, a beautiful Japanese divorcee he impressed with his intellect. Hirschfield also embraced his Jewish heritage. "I did the Holocaust in rhyme," he recalled of an educational poem he'd perform on the bus. "The city sounded like a swinging rhythm section. Brakes hissed, horns honked, passengers rang the bell." As Hirschfield recited his rhymes alone, he had become just another crazy person talking to himself on public transport. Then, one afternoon, as he waited at a bus stop in Hollywood, a man selling jewelry overheard him and suggested he take his lyrics to Limerick Park. Intrigued, he rode a bus headed into South Central, past Crenshaw's Magic Johnson Theater, the neighborhood's megachurches, and liquor stores. At 43rd and Limerick, he found a crowd of teenagers surrounding a community art center called the KAOS Network. This had to be it. Spontaneous rap battles were breaking out, and dancers writhed on the sidewalk. At the entrance, a young man sized him up. Would you like to hear something? Hirschfeld asked politely. Sure. What's your name? The man asked. Hirschfeld looked at him. My name is Dr. Rapp. Established in 1984 as a media production center, Chaos Network was famous for Project Blowed, an open mic workshop for up-and-coming rappers. It was underground, powerful, strong, and scary for people if they weren't ready, because it was really volatile, explained the proprietor, Ben Caldwell, a 73-year-old African-American filmmaker. The project was a tough breeding ground for rappers who hoped to blow up, like the underground performer Akaelon, or more mainstream stars like Jurassic 5. But Hirschfeld knew nothing about any of this. He said he wanted to do a rhyme on the Holocaust, Caldwell remembered. This was unusual, but not against the mother mm-mm rules pinned on the door that began, Project Blowed is presented for the love of hip-hop, entirely for black people. The entrance fee was $2 to perform, $4 to watch. When a rapper forgot his line, stuttered, or showed up unprepared, the crowd forced him off stage with a devastating chant, "Please pass the mic." The DJ demanded Hirschfeld's backing music. He handed over a cassette tape of Chopin. Alone on the stage, Hirschfeld gripped the mic and began, "God, this is a tough thing to write. The feeling I got in my heart tonight, just to think of the Holocaust, so deep and sadly blue, and still so many people don't think it's true." The first time he was up there, he wasn't that successful, Caldwell said. The crowd was silent. Here was an old man reading a poem. As he emerged into the hot South Central night, Hirschfeld heard a voice from Fifth Street Dick's, the neighboring coffee shop. "If you can't keep up with those kids, then you'd better do something else." Undeterred, Hirschfeld put aside his Tchaikovsky records and listened to NWA and Run DMC. When Machiko found out he was preparing for rap battles in South Central, she told him, "You're crazy." But she couldn't stop him from returning to Project Blowed every week. "Sherman's leaving at 10 o'clock at night and going to Crenshaw," she told her son, Scott. Scott, who had transitioned from a teenage professional skateboarder into a hip-hop DJ, was now in his 20s. Scott encouraged his stepfather to be more like the hip-hop rappers he admired, among them KRS-One. In the mid-1980s, KRS-One had emerged from the Bronx as the MC of Boogie Down Productions, with a seminal album, Criminal Minded. As a solo artist, he'd created one of hip-hop's most enduring records, Sound of Da Police. One evening in October 1999, Hirschfeld heard that KRS-One was speaking about rap history at an event in Hollywood and decided to swing by. During the Q&A, Hirschfeld grabbed the mic. He explained that he was getting his language back together after a stroke by listening to rap records, one of which was one of my songs, KRS-One recalled. Hirschfeld couldn't stop himself. "I started to have a stroke," he rapped. "Went broke. I started to think and speak in rhyme. I can do it all the time, and I want to get to do the rap, and I won't take any more of this crap." He got a standing ovation, called KRS-One. He gave the doctor his telephone. When Hirschfeld told his stepson about his new friend, Scott was stunned. "You know, you should really listen to his music and listen to his lyrics," he told his stepfather. But inside, Scott was thinking, "Let's see how long this lasts. KRS-One?" Every week for 2 or 3 years, Hirschfeld climbed on stage at Project Blowed and gave his everything. Sweat on his brow, steam on his glasses, fist pumping. Sometimes he electrified the crowd. Other times, "Please pass the mic." He learned to self-promote and name-check Dr. Rapp and his lyrics, just like the pros. He performed on the stage in impromptu ciphers under street lamps until the sun came up. "He was tight," the rapper Micah 9 told me, while he smoked in an alleyway before a performance at Culver City. He had a little bit of an angular approach. He had flows, he had good lines, and they were thought out. I remember a couple of punch lines that came off pretty cool. Hirschfeld's double life became strained. His voice became hoarse from shouting rhymes over African drums and staying out all night. Then one particularly hot evening, everything went black. Dr. Rapp had a seizure, recalled Tasha Wiggins, who worked for Chaos Network. Other rappers caught him. Everybody stopped what they were doing, trying to nurture Dr. Rapp. As Hirschfeld lay unconscious on the floor, the crowd started chanting his name. Those who have been struck by the strange side effects of brain injuries often speak of their gratitude. Just before he died of cancer, Tommy McHugh, the British convict who became an artist, said his strokes were the most wonderful thing. McHugh and Hirschfeld both experienced symptoms of what the physician and author Olivia Sacks called sudden musicophilia, an eruption of creativity following a brain injury or stroke. But for Hirschfeld, rhyming was no longer a symptom, but a cure. It was as if one side of Hirschfeld's brain that held the rhymes healed the broken side that had short-circuited. Brain scans on rappers carried out by the National Institute of Deafness and Other Communication Disorders, NIDCD, discovered that during freestyle rapping, brain activity increased in the brain areas that engage motivation, language, mood, and action. Even after Hirschfeld collapsed that night in Limerick Park, he used hip-hop to regain his speech and return to the stage. Soon, Dr. Rapp's notices at Project Bloat improved. His name was on the lips of the multitudes, recalled Ed Boyer, a Los Angeles Times journalist who first heard rumors about South Central's rapping doctor in April 2000. As Dr. Rapp stepped into the spotlight and the DJ's needle found the groove, he became lost in his rhymes. Me, I'm just a beginning medical intern of rap, trying to express and open my trap. Hirschfeld's stepson, Scott, remembers the morning he opened the Times and saw a photograph of Dr. Rapp wearing an Adidas tracksuit mid-flow on the paper's Metro pages. Dr. Rapp had finally blown up. Radio and television crews soon descended on Limerick Park. Ben Caldwell showed me footage from a Japanese television station which filmed Hirschfeld waiting to take the mic. He looked like a retiree standing in line for an early bird dinner special. Then he laid down his rhymes as the crowd bobbed their heads in appreciation. Afterward, Hirschfeld took a nap on a couch. He did that quite regularly, Caldwell sighed. I can't clearly tell you whether rap helped him, said Machiko, but I can tell you he was happy when he was doing rap music. Hirschfeld represented Project Bloat until ill health forced him to quit both music and medicine. He died from cancer in Los Angeles on March 29, 2013, at age 76. Today, Project Bloat lives on every third Tuesday at Chaos Network in Limerick Park. But Limerick Park is now fighting a new battle against gentrification. The reason Hirschfeld was accepted at Project Bloat, said Caldwell, was that he arrived with an open mind, and he listened and learned. That's one wonderful thing I like most about black American communities, he said. As long as you don't try to tell them how to do their own culture, you're good. Ever since Dr. Rapp's days, performers of all races and backgrounds have jumped on stage, added Caldwell. But the moment they stutter or slur, it's always the same. Pass the mic. This was adapted from an article first published in The Atlantic. On the Talking Points page now, we'll start with Buttigieg. Can a true Christian be gay? Pete Buttigieg is trying to win the presidency by breaking the Republican lock on God, said Timothy Egan in the New York Times. The 37-year-old Rhodes Scholar, Navy veteran, and mayor of South Bend, Indiana, formally entered the Democratic presidential race this week after surging to third place in several polls. Surprisingly for a modern Democrat, he's a proud Christian, eloquently explaining how faith informs his desire for compassionate immigration policy and universal health care. Mayor Pete, as he likes to be called, is gay. He proudly shows off his husband, Jason, and has said their marriage has moved me closer to God. That's a pointed challenge to social conservatives like Vice President Mike Pence, who insist on their right to view homosexuality as a sin and gay marriage as a moral wrong. To the Mike Pences of the world, Buttigieg recently said, "Your quarrel is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my Creator." Buttigieg shouldn't lecture anyone about Christianity, said Eric Erickson in the Resurgent.com. He attacks President Trump for ignoring biblical commands to care for the least of these. But Buttigieg himself ignores the inconvenient parts of faith, namely the express statements in the scripture that homosexuality is a sin. Pence, meanwhile, has been unfailingly courteous to his fellow Hoosier, said Ben Shapiro in NationalReview.com. Yet at virtually every campaign stop, Buttigieg paints the VP as a closed-minded bigot. If Buttigieg truly understood Christianity, he would know that Pence's traditional reading of the Bible doesn't mean he has any personal animus against gay people. If not animus, then ignorance, said Ed Kilgore in nymag.com. Conservative Christians' homophobia is based on the belief that being gay is a choice made in conscious defiance of God and nature, an assumption that's fading away as straight people get to know openly gay friends, family members, and colleagues. Pence and his allies like to hide behind the old canard of loving the sinner but hating the sin, said Bob Moser in newrepublic.com. But Buttigieg is using the powerful platform of his presidential candidacy to point out that the dehumanizing laws, public policies, and court rulings evangelicals seek would make gay people second-class citizens, which is anything but loving. His eloquence on this topic has left champions of Bible-based intolerance furious and scared. A related article here, not directly but indirectly. Benedict, blame the sexual revolution. For 6 years, Pope Emeritus Benedict the 16th has been content to spend retirement practicing his Mozart at the piano and tending his vegetable patch, said Tom Kington in Los Angeles Times. But now the former pope, age 91, has broken his self-imposed silence with an incendiary essay. In it, he blames the church's sexual abuse crisis on a society-wide erosion of rules and morality, triggered by the sexual revolution. In the 20 years from 1960 to 1980, the previously normative standards regarding sexuality collapsed entirely, Benedict writes. Priests internalized society's new belief that sexual expression of all kinds was natural and moral, Benedict says, so that even pedophilia came to seem as allowed and appropriate. Benedict's successor, Pope Francis, has blamed clericalism, or priests who emphasize power over service. So this new contradictory analysis has sent shockwaves through the church. This is really not good for the faithful, said Tom Jelton in NPR.org. Catholics now have two papal perspectives on the clergy abuse crisis and may feel free to choose between them. To this conservative Catholic, Benedict's diagnosis of the problem is far more perceptive, said Michael Brennan Doherty in NationalReview.com. He traces the moral anarchy within the church to a certain casual or flippant attitude toward God that became widespread in the 1960s and 70s. Why did pedophilia reach such proportions, Benedict asks? Ultimately, the reason is the absence of God. In his critique, Benedict even provides a solution to the crisis. the Catholics must once again fear and honor a living God. Benedict's self-justifying letter ignores the facts, said David Vondrell in the Washington Post. As we now know from investigations worldwide, many abuse cases occurred long before the fateful 60s. But in his arrogance, Benedict believes that priests raped children and bishops covered it up because the rest of us in society forced it through our godless depravity. In reality, the blame lies with the bishops and cardinals who covered up thousands of cases of child abuse by authorizing hush money payoffs to victims, attacking truth tellers, and sending monstrous offenders on spiritual retreats rather than turning them over to the authorities. The only salvation for the corrupted church is sincere and prolonged confession and atonement by the hierarchy, not Benedict's astonishing denial of responsibility. Sorry, but two popes is one too many. Just enough time for a couple of short notes. Fox News and Fox Business mention Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's name every single day between February 25th and April 7th, a total of 3,181 times. That's an average 75 times a day. A new study shows that autism rates in New Jersey climbed from 1% of children born in 1992 to nearly 3% born in 2010. This is the highest rate ever recorded for a state. The national average is 1.3%. And we'll finish out with a quote from Jane Fonda, quoted in the Sunday Times, who says, "I like being over the hill. I've discovered there's a whole new landscape." And that's it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.